Good day, this is Mary, and I'm reading Newsmax for the Talking Information Centre. It is December 23rd, nearly the end of the year, and Christmas is approaching. Okay, first story is US economy expands a surprising 4.3% in third quarter. The US economy expanded at a surprisingly strong 4.3% annual rate in the third quarter as consumer spending, exports and government spending all grew. US gross domestic product from July through September, the economy's total output of goods and services, rose from its 3.8% growth rate in April to June quarter, the Commerce Department said Tuesday. Analysis surveyed by the data firm FactSet forecast growth of 3% in the period. However, inflation remains higher than the Federal Reserve would like. The Fed's favored inflation gauge, called the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, or PCE, climbed to a 2.8% annual pace last quarter, up from 2.1% in the second quarter. Excluding volatile food and energy prices, so-called core PCE inflation was 2.9, up from 2.6 in the April to June quarter. Consumer spending, which accounts for about 70% of U.S. economic activity, rose to a 3.5% annual pace last quarter, up from 2.5 in the April to June period. And also from Newsmax, there's a report out U.S. seeks to cancel thousands of asylum cases. The Trump administration launched a nationwide campaign to void asylum claims of thousands of people with active cases in immigration courts by arguing that they can be deported to countries that are not their own, CBS News reported on Tuesday. Reuters could not immediately confirm the report. The White House, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and the Department of Homeland Security did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The administration's new tactic involves ICE attorneys asking immigration judges to dismiss asylum cases without hearing them on merits, the report said. ICE attorneys have also asked the judges to order asylum seekers to be deported to countries such as Guatemala, Honduras, Ecuador, and Uganda, the report added. The report comes as President Donald Trump is preparing... is preparing for a more aggressive immigration crackdown in 2026 with billions of dollars in new funding. ICE and Border Patrol will get $170 billion in additional funds through September of 2029, a huge surge of funding over their existing annual budgets of about $19 billion, after the Republican-controlled Congress passed a massive spending package in July. And Trump's anti-DEI campaign faces high legal hurdles. President Donald Trump's Anti-Discrimination Enforcement Agency has a high bar to clear to prove companies' diversity, equity, and inclusion policies run afoul of the law, according to interviews with more than a dozen corporate legal and compliance experts. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, under new chair Andrea Lucas, is making a sharp pivot toward what she calls a more conservative view of civil rights, like prioritizing cases of discrimination against white men. That shift, coupled with the Trump administration's aggressive campaign to dismantle DEI programs, is set to collide with the boundaries of the U.S. discrimination law, long a cornerstone of workplace equality. The move signals a broader campaign to redefine the meaning of workplace fairness, setting up a potential clash with corporate America, which has widely adopted DEI measures to hire and retain diverse talent. Lucas plans to open inquiries into corporate DEI practices to find whether employers made race or sex-based decisions, she told Reuters in an exclusive interview last week. Specifically, she called for submissions of possible instances of discrimination against white men by corporate DEI practices. But a program is not illegal just because the administration says so, said former EEOC Chair Jenny Yang. The agency still has to build a case and convince the courts that a company's programs violate discrimination law. In many situations, the work that might fall within the umbrella term of diversity, equity, inclusion is foundational work to prevent discrimination and ensure equal opportunity, which is the employer's obligation under the law, Yang said. Still, as chair, Lucas has full suite of legal options to investigate companies that have DEI programs. She can subpoena for documents, depose executives, and sue for any violation of workplace laws. The EEOC's looming transformation comes after nearly a year of mostly posturing against companies, since Trump issued a pair of anti-DEI executive orders less than 48 hours after he was sworn into office in January, purging the government of DEI initiatives, offices, and personnel, and mandating every federal agency to discourage private entities from implementing DEI initiatives. Conservatives like Robbie Starbuck, a right-wing anti-DEI influencer, are capitalizing on the moment and trying to get the administration's policies into law. I've had a lot of conversations about that with lawmakers because that is very, very important part of this, he said in an interview. You have got to codify this into law. It's much harder to kill it than an executive order. Lucas said she is ready to prove, in court if necessary, that harm has been done to white men as a result of DEI programs. She cited a widely circulated article in Compact magazine, known for its array of bipartisan populist writers, alleging individuals were turned down for jobs because of diversity hiring initiatives, a common conservative refrain that has been vocally criticized by experts and diversity advocates. If we have a charge of discrimination against you, we're going to use the full force of the federal government to remedy it, Lucas said. This is a pro-enforcement, pro-American worker administration. But there is still a high legal bar to clear. Rutgers law professor Stacey Hawkins said, people alleging discrimination have to demonstrate that a job, promotion, benefits, or other compensation were denied because they were male and white, and because an employer referred the race or sex of someone else. Most of the time, it is not that white men have been discriminated against, but that the pool of applicants has grown, and there is more legitimate competition from people of color, Hawkins said. The job market was marked by government-approved exclusion and discrimination for decades before reform, she added. And now, excuse me. In many situations, the work might fall within the umbrella term of diversity, equity, inclusion in its foundational work to prevent discrimination and ensure equal opportunity, which is the employer's obligation under the law, Yang said. Still, as chair, Lucas has full suite of legal options to investigate companies that have DEI programs. She can subpoena for documents, depose executives, and sue for any violation of workplace laws. The EEOC's looming transformation comes after nearly a year of mostly posturing against companies. Since Trump issued a pair of anti-DEI executive orders less than 48 hours after he was sworn into office in January, purging the government of DEI initiatives, offices and personnel, and mandating every federal agency to discourage private entities from implementing DEI initiatives. Conservatives like Bobby Starbuck and right-wing anti-DEI influencer are capitalizing on the moment and trying to get the administration's policies into law. I've had a lot of conversations about that with lawmakers because it's a very, very important part of this, he said in an interview. You've got to codify this into law. It's much harder to kill than if it's an executive order. Lucas said she is ready to prove in court if necessary, that harm has been done to white men as a result of DEI programs. She cited a widely circulated article in Compact magazine, known for its array of bipartisan populist writers, alleging individuals were turned down for jobs because of diversity hiring initiatives, a common conservative refrain that has been vocally criticized by experts and diversity advocates. If we have a charge of discrimination against you, we're going to use the full force of the federal government to remedy it, Lucas said. This is a pro-enforcement, pro-American worker administration. But there is still a high legal bar to clear. Rutgers law professor Stacey Hawkins said, people alleging discrimination have to demonstrate that a job, promotion, benefits or other compensation were denied because they were male and white and because an employer preferred the race or sex of someone else. Most of the time, it is not that the white men have been discriminated against, but that the pool of applicants has grown and there is more legitimate competition from people of color, Hawkins said. The job market was marked by government-approved exclusion and discrimination for decades before reform, she added. And now white men have to compete against a wider, diverse pool of qualified job applicants. The thing that has changed is that other people are not being discriminated against, Hawkins said. Most companies and industries have also retooled their DEI programs to stay legally sound. The larger automakers are mostly on top of this with legal audits, rebranding, and program modifications. The basic tenets of corporate DEI doctrine rest on three core principles: ensuring representation of people from diverse backgrounds across all levels of workforce, equal compensation for every employee, and fostering a sense of belonging, all to eliminate systematic bias in the workplace. Employers recognize the need to hire and retain a workforce that reflects their customers as a strategic business decision that is crucial to long-term success for their employees and shareholders, said former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams. It explains why the vast majority of companies have kept their DEI programs and will continue to, despite the bluster from the White House, she said. DEI is essential for us to ensure that there are pathways to opportunity and that we continue to remove barriers, said Abrams, who started a non-profit DEI advocacy and consulting group, American Pride Rises, in 2023. Most people agree with DEI, most companies practice DEI, and most Americans want a democracy that defends DEI. Damn. Two men are found guilty of UK plot to kill hundreds of Jews. Two men were found guilty Tuesday of plotting to kill hundreds of in an Islamic State-inspired gun rampage against the Jewish community in England. A planned attack, investigators say, demonstrates the resurgent risk posed by the terrorist group. Police and prosecutors said Waleed Sadoui, 38, and Amar Hassan, 52, who went on trial a week after an unrelated deadly attack on a synagogue in a nearby northwest city of Manchester in October, were Islamic extremists who wanted to use automatic firearms to kill as many Jews as they could. Had their plans come to fruition, it would have resulted in one, if not the deadliest terrorist attack in UK history, said Assistant Chief Constable Robert Potts, in charge of counter-terrorism policing in northwest England. Their convictions come little more than a week after a mass shooting at a Jewish Hanukkah celebration on Sydney's Bondi Beach, in which 15 people were killed. Islamic State said that the Australian attacks were a source of pride, although the jihadist group did not claim responsibility. In response, has heightened fears as an increase in violent Islamist extremism. While not posing the same threat of a decade ago when Islamic State controlled vast areas of Iraq and Syria, European security officials caution that ISIS and affiliated al-Qaeda groups are once again looking to export violence abroad, radicalizing would-be attackers online. You can see signs of some of those terrorism threats starting to grow again and starting to escalate, British Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper said last week. British prosecutors told jurors that Sadoui and Hassan had embraced the views of Islamic State and were prepared to risk their own lives in order to become martyrs. Sadoui had arranged for 2 assault rifles, an automatic pistol, and almost 200 rounds of ammunition to be smuggled into Britain through the port of Dover, when he was arrested in May of 2024, prosecutor Harpreet Sandhu said. He added that Sadoui planned to obtain 2 more rifles, another pistol, and collect at least 900 rounds. Unbeknown to him, a man known as Farouk, he was trying to get the weapons from, was an undercover operative, which police said meant his plan never came close to being put into operation. Sanhu said that the assault rifles Sandhu wanted were similar to those used in a 2015 Islamic terrorist attack on the Bataclan concert hall in Paris that killed 130 people. He added that Sandhu hero-worshipped Abdulhamid Abadou, who coordinated that attack. Sadoui said in a message to Farouk, whom he thought was a feral terrorist, that the Paris attack was the biggest operation after that of Osama bin Laden, an apparent reference to the September 11, 2001 attack on the United States. Based on Walid's communications and interactions with the undercover operative, and some of the things he said, that made it very clear that he regarded a less sophisticated attack with less lethal weaponry as not being good enough, Potts said. Because, in effect, it was his role and his duty to kill as many Jewish people as he could, and that wasn't going to be achieved via the use of a knife or, for example, potentially a vehicle as a weapon. Both Sadoui and Hassan had pleaded not guilty, and Sadoui said that he played along with the plot out of fear for his life. Hassan did not give evidence and barely attended his trial after he angrily shouted from the dock on the first day, "How many babies?" in that apparent reference to Israel's war in Gaza. They were convicted in Preston Crown Court on a single charge of preparing terrorist acts. Walid Sadoui's brother, Bayil Sadoui, 36, was found guilty of failing to disclose information about acts of terrorism, but prosecutors said he had been reluctant to join the attack. The foiled plot is the latest in Britain and elsewhere inspired by Islamic State, which emerged in Iraq and Syria a decade ago and quickly created a caliphate, declaring its rule over all Muslims and largely displacing al-Qaeda. At the height of its power from 2014 to 2017, Islamic State held swaths of the two countries, ruling over millions of people and imposing a strict, brutal interpretation of Islamic Sharia law. Its fighters also carried out or inspired attacks in dozens of cities around the world, which were often claimed by Islamic State, even without any actual connection. The SITE intelligence group said in the wake of the Bondi Beach attack in Australia that IS had encouraged Muslims to take action elsewhere, particularly singling out Belgium. A European intelligence official speaking on condition of anonymity said IS was flooding social media with propaganda. And while this impacted only a handful of people, it meant there were more terrorism investigations than last year. Ken McCallum, head of Britain's domestic spy agency, MI5, said in October that his service and the police had thwarted 19 late-stage attack plots since the start of 2020 and intervened to counter many hundreds of other terrorist threats. Terrorism breeds in squalid corners of the internet, where poisonous ideologies of whatever sort meet volatile, often chaotic individual lives, McCallum said. And also from Newsmax, New York Times reporter sues Google, XAI, OpenAI over chatbot training. An investigative reporter, best known for exposing fraud at Silicon Valley blood testing startup Theranos, sued Elon Musk's XAI, Anthropic, Google, OpenAI, Meta Platforms, and Perplexity on Monday for using copyrighted books without permission to train their artificial intelligence systems. New York Times reporter said Bad Blood author John Carreyrou filed the lawsuit in California federal court with five other writers, accusing the AI companies of pirating their books and feeding them into the large language models, LLMs, that power the company's chatbots. The lawsuit is one of several copyright cases brought by authors and other copyright owners against tech companies over the use of their work in AI training. The case is the first to name XAI as a defendant. The spokesperson for Perplexity said that the company doesn't index books. Spokespeople for the other defendants did not immediately respond to requests for comment on the lawsuit. Unlike other pending cases, the writers are not seeking to band together in a larger class action, a type of lawsuit they said favors defendants by allowing them to negotiate a single settlement with many plaintiffs. LLM companies should not be able to so easily extinguish thousands upon thousands of high-value claims at bargain basement rates, the complainant said. Anthropic reached the first major settlement in an AI training copyright dispute in August, agreeing to pay $1.5 billion to a class of authors who said the company pirated millions of books. The new lawsuit said class members in that case will receive a tiny fraction, just 2%, of the Copyright Act statutory ceiling of $150,000 per infringed work. Monday's complaint was filed by attorneys at law firm Friedman, Norman, Friedland, including Kyle Roche, whom Carreyrou profiled in a 2023 New York Times article. During a November hearing in the Anthropic class action, U.S. District Judge William Alsup criticized a separate law firm Roche co-founded for gathering authors to opt out of the opt out of the settlement in search of a sweeter deal. Roche declined to comment on Monday. Carreyrou told the judge at a later hearing that stealing books to build its AI was Anthropic's original sin and that the settlement did not go far enough. And also from Newsmax, a new law aims to curb $200 million in improper Medicaid payments to dead people. Medicaid programs made more than $200 million in improper payments to healthcare providers between 2021 and 2022 for people who had already died, according to a new report from the independent watchdog for the Department of Health and Human Services. But the department's Office of Inspector General said it expects a new provision in Republicans' One Big Beautiful Bill, requiring states to audit their Medicaid beneficiary lists may help reduce these improper payments in the future. These kind of improper payments are not unique to one state, and the issue continues to be persistent. Anna Sanchez, Deputy Regional Inspector General in the Office of Audit Services, told the Associated Press. Sanchez has been researching this issue for a decade. The White Dog report released Tuesday said that more $207.5 million in managed care payments were made on behalf of deceased enrollees between July of 21 to July of 2022. The office recommends. Wait a minute. The office recommends that the federal government share more information with state governments to recover the incorrect payments, including a Social Security database known as the Full Death Master File, which contains more than 142 million records going back to 1899. Sharing the Full Death Master File data has been tightly restricted due to privacy laws which protect against identity theft and fraud. The massive tax and spending bill that was signed into law by President Donald Trump this summer expands how the Full Death Master File can be used by mandating Medicaid agencies to quarterly audit their provider and beneficiary lists against the file, beginning in 2027. The intent is to stop payments to dead people and improve accuracy. Tuesday's report is the first nationwide look at improper Medicaid payments. Since 2016, HHS Inspector General has conducted 18 audits on a selection of state programs and had identified that Medicaid agencies had improperly made managed care payments on behalf of deceased enrollees, totaling approximately $289 million. The government had some success using the Full Death Master File to prevent improper payments earlier this year. In January, the Treasury Department reported that it had clawed back more than $31 million in federal payments that improperly went to dead people as part of a five-month pilot program after Congress gave Treasury temporary access to the file for 3 years as part of the 2021 Appropriations Bill. Excuse me. Meanwhile, the SSA has been making unusual updates to the file itself, adding and removing records and complicating its use. For instance, the Trump administration in April moved to classify thousands of living immigrants as dead and cancel their Social Security numbers to crack down on immigrants who had been temporarily allowed to live in the U.S., under programs started during the Biden administration. And also from Newsmax, Netanyahu warns of a very severe response if Iran attacks Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned on Monday of a very severe response should Iran take action against Israel, while emphasizing that the Jewish state is not seeking confrontation. Speaking at a joint press conference in Jerusalem alongside the leaders of Greece and Cyprus, the premier said that Israel is aware of recent Iranian exercises, referring to an Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps missile drill, which, according to Axios, Jerusalem has warned the Trump administration could be a cover for a strike against Israel. "We are following this and we are making the necessary preparations," said Netanyahu. I want to make it clear to Iran here, any action against Israel will be met with severe response. Netanyahu spoke following a trilateral summit with Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis and Cypriot President Nikos Christodoulos. Asked if the Islamic Republic would be on the table during his sixth meeting with President Donald Trump, scheduled for December 29th at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, Netanyahu affirmed that it will be discussed, saying that we are not seeking confrontation with anyone. We seek stability, prosperity, and peace. The premier added that there were great achievements during the 12-day war with Iran in June, stressing that our basic expectations from Iran have not changed, a position that Washington shares, namely... Washington shares, namely, the level of enrichment and other activities, the ending of the proxy wars against us. In a video aired on Tuesday, U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee responded to reports that the Islamic Republic is attempting to rebuild its nuclear and missile programs just 6 months after the joint Israeli-American operation, arguing that Tehran's actions pose a threat to the entire world, not just the Jewish state. Iran, I don't know if they ever took him, Trump, seriously until the night that the B-2 bombers went to Fordo. I hope they got the message, but apparently they didn't get the full message, he said during an interview with the Institute for National Security Studies, the INSS, at the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. They appear to be trying to reconstitute and find a new way to dig the hole deeper. Secure it more, he added. Huckabee stressed that Iran threatens not just Israel, but the United States and Europe, and warned that if the Europeans fail to comprehend this, then they're dumber than I sometimes think they are. At the same time, he said, he was pleased that snapback sanctions were recently reimposed against the regime in Tehran, calling them very important and saying that more of these types of actions will help to maybe choke off Iran's ability to do what they're trying to do. Huckabee emphasized that the Iranian regime has threatened America for 46 consecutive years since 1979 when the Ayatollahs took power. They've always said death to Israel, death to America in the same sentence. This was never a separation. Israel is only the appetizer because you're closer and you're an easier target than the vast geographical expanse that represents the United States, said Huckabee. But they've never hidden the fact that the real entree, their ultimate goal, is to destroy the United States. Because if you want to destroy Western civilization and move the world back to the 7th century and take us back to a place that, thank God, doesn't exist anymore, then you cannot do that without taking the United States down, the diplomat continued. And that's why they have said for all of these 46 years, death to America. And Toyota is to recall more than 55,000 U.S. vehicles. Toyota is recalling 405,000 vehicles in the U.S. as bolt inside the inverter might not have been tightened properly, causing incomplete contact at the inverter terminal, the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration said Tuesday. The remedy is currently under development, NHTSA said. And also from Newsmax, the Kansas City Chiefs announced they will leave Arrowhead, relocate across Kansas-Missouri border. The Kansas City Chiefs announced Monday that they will leave their longtime home at Arrowhead Stadium for a new dome stadium that will be built across the Kansas-Missouri state line and be ready for the start of the 2031 season. The announcement came shortly after a council of top Kansas lawmakers voted unanimously inside a packed room at the state capitol to allow the state to issue a little more than $2.4 billion in bonds to cover about 60% of the cost of the new stadium, a new training facility, and retail and entertainment space. The bonds will be paid off with state sales and liquor tax revenues generated in a defined area around it. The location of the Chiefs games will change, Chiefs owner Clark Hunt said after the meeting. But some things won't change. Our fans will still be the loudest in the NFL. Our games will still be the best place in the world to tailgate, and our players and coaches will be ready to compete for championships because on the field or off the field, we are big dreamers, and we're ready for the next chapter. The Chiefs intend their $3 billion stadium project to be built in Kansas City, Kansas, near the Kansas Speedway, and a retail district known as the Legends. The area includes Children's Mercy Park, the home of MLS Club Sporting Kansas City, and Legends Field, the home of the Kansas City Monarchs minor league baseball team. The Chiefs also plan to build their $300 million practice facility in the Kansas City metro suburb of Olathe, Kansas. They're committed to at least $700 million in other development. Today's announcement is truly historic. Actually, it's a little surreal, Kansas Governor Laura Kelly said. Today's announcement will touch the lives of Kansians for generations to come. Today's announcement is the total game changer for our state. We have always been Chief fans, Kelly said. Now we are Chiefs family. State officials also predict that more than 20,000 new construction jobs will be created. While the final location for the stadium has not been decided, Chiefs President Mark Donovan said it would seat about 65,000, roughly 10,000 fewer fans, than Arrowhead Stadium. That follows a trend across professional sports of building stadiums and arenas that have fewer overall seats but more amenities, luxury seating, and premium spaces. We have a lot of work to do. We're still early in the process, Hunt said. In the months ahead, we will hire an architect and a contractor to get to work on the 5-plus-year timeline to build a stadium. The move by the Chiefs is a massive blow to Missouri lawmakers and Governor Mike Keogh, who had been working on their own funding package to prevent a third NFL franchise and the second in a decade from leaving their borders. The Rams left St. Louis for Los Angeles in part due to their inability to secure funding to help replace the dome at America's Center. Keogh had backed a special legislative session in June to authorize bonds covering up to 50% of the cost of the new or renovated stadiums, plus up to $50 million of tax credits for each stadium, and unspecified aid from local governments. They thought new and shiny was better than old and reliable, Keogh said after the Chiefs' announcement, adding that the club was in discussions with Missouri officials about staying at a renovated or rebuilt Arrowhead Stadium as late as last week. We won't give up. We'll look for cracks in the armor and find out if there's a Missouri show-me solution through our Sports Act. But both Hunt and Donovan said Kansas had a key advantage. The team was negotiating only with state officials, rather than with state and local officials, as in Missouri. The Chiefs originally planned an $800 million renovation of Arrowhead Stadium in a joint effort with the Royals, who are similarly planning to build a new facility to replace Kauffman Stadium. The facilities sit a couple of hundred yards apart, across a parking lot, and both teams have leases with Jackson County, Missouri, that expire in January of 2031. But last year, Jackson County voters soundly defeated a local sales tax extension that would have helped to pay for those renovations to the football stadium while helping to fund a new ballpark for the Royals in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. That energized Kansas efforts to lure both teams. The Royals were not discussed by Kansas lawmakers Monday, but momentum appears to be building behind their own move across the state line. An affiliate of the club already has purchased the mortgage on a tract of land in Overland Park, Kansas. While the Chiefs aren't going far away and aren't gone yet, today is a setback as the Kansas Citan, a former Chiefs season ticket holder and lifelong Chiefs fan, said Quentin Lucas, the mayor of Kansas City, Missouri, business decisions are a reality. And we all understand that, but Arrowhead Stadium is more. It's family, tradition, and part of Kansas City. We will never leave. Hunt has long said his preference was to renovate Arrowhead Stadium, which was beloved by his father and team founder, the late Lamar Hunt. It is considered one of the jewels of the NFL alongside Lambeau Field in Green Bay, and is revered for its tailgating scene and home field advantage. It currently holds the Guinness World Record for the loudest stadium roar. This summer, Arrowhead Stadium will host 6 World Cup matches, including matches in the round of 32 and quarterfinals. Donovan told reporters Monday that the Hunt family believed Lamar Hunt would have backed their decision because he would have wanted to increase and enhance the fans' experience. Lamar Hunt established the Chiefs on August 14th of 1959. The team was originally based in Dallas and known as the Texans, but Hunt was convinced by then Kansas City Mayor H. Roe Bartle to relocate the team to Missouri, with promises of tripling the team's season ticket sales and expanding the seating capacity of Municipal Stadium. In 1972, the team moved into Arrowhead Stadium at the Truman Sports Complex just east of downtown Kansas City. The stadium has undergone numerous renovations through the years, allowing it to stay relevant in a changing sports landscape. But there has been little economic development around the stadium. The facility itself is starting to show wear and tear, and there is a limit to the number of luxury suites and amenities that the franchise can utilize to help drive revenue. While the Hunt family has long loved Arrowhead Stadium, it has warmed in recent years to the idea of a replacement. Not only would it solve many of the shortcomings of the Chiefs' longtime home, a new facility with a fixed or retractable roof would allow them to use it year-round. That would mean the potential for hosting more concerts and events, college football bowl games, the Final Four, and perhaps one of Lamar Hunt's long-held dreams, a Super Bowl. Chiefs fans on both sides of the state line can tell you that the success we've enjoyed together has elevated the profile of the entire region, Clark Hunt said. Sports are woven into the fabric of this community. If you travel and go to New York or Los Angeles or Europe or South America, you don't have to tell people which side of the state line you're from. You tell them you're from Kansas City. And there are pretty good chance their response might have something to do with the Chiefs. And also from Newsmax, Hunter slams Biden border, Kabul debacles. Hunter Biden ripped into infamous decisions made under his father, former President Joe Biden, a wide-open southern border policy, and the U.S. military's disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan. In a marathon interview on The Sean Ryan Show, released Monday, the former first son said that the Biden-era immigration approach became a disaster and acknowledged the chaotic Kabul exit that left 13 U.S. service members dead was an obvious failure. Hunter Biden argued that the U.S. needs vibrant legal immigration, but warned the country doesn't want immigrants that are coming here illegally, draining us of resources and being prioritized above veterans and other Americans struggling at home. The comments came during an exchange with host Sean Ryan, who pointed to the contrast many Americans see between overwhelmed veteran services and taxpayer-funded benefits for illegal immigrants in major cities. Hunter Biden pushed back on the idea that cutting benefits for migrants would automatically solve problems at the Department of Veterans Affairs, insisting his father cared about veterans and pointing to the PACT Act as one example of support. Still, his broader admission underscored what Republicans have argued for years. The Biden administration lost operational control of the border and refused to aggressively enforce existing law until political pressure peaked. Government projections have also highlighted the scale of the surge. The Congressional Budget Office projected net immigration of about 2.4 million people per year in 2023 and 2024. In an other foreign nationals category before falling back toward historical levels afterward. Hunter Biden also revived a familiar Democratic talking point, claiming a sweeping border bill negotiated by Senators James Lankford, Republican Ohio, Kirsten Sinema, Independent Arizona, and Chris Murphy, Democrat Connecticut, had GOP support until Donald Trump intervened ahead of the 2024 election. Republicans have countered that enforcement tools already existed and that then-President Joe Biden simply chose not to use them, while Trump, in both campaigns and executive actions, has emphasized deterrence, removals, and limiting asylum abuse. On Afghanistan, Hunter Biden said leaving the country was the right thing to do after two decades of war, but he faulted the execution of the withdrawal and stressed that accountability rests with the commander-in-chief. He referenced the ISIS-K suicide bombing at Kabul's airport during the evacuation that killed 13 U.S. troops and roughly 170 Afghan civilians. I think that there was a better way to do it, and I can blame it on his generals. I can blame it on other people for the way in which we did it, but, and my dad always knew this also, is that the buck stops with him, Hunter Biden said. Hunter Biden added that his father was crushed by the deaths, but his blunt assessment will likely feel renewed scrutiny of the Biden's team planning and its deadly consequences, an issue Republicans have long argued became a symbol of diminished American credibility abroad. And before we close for the day, a little story for Christmas called The Toy Escape. Late Christmas Eve, when all was still and the room was dark as night, the Christmas tree lit magically. It was a fantastic sight. Then from around the tree trunk came a strange and funny sound as gifts began to unwrap themselves and toys jumped out all around. The music box began to play, and in a crazy trance, the candy canes jumped off the tree to do a silly dance. The big stuffed bear leapt to his feet to see what he could see. He rode a shiny, bright red bike around the Christmas tree. The new toy kitchen started to cook, and before you could blink an eye, the oven door opened, and from inside came a tiny pizza pie. A squirt gun squirted everything. It knew what it was for. By the time that it was emptied out, a big puddle lay on the floor. A beautiful doll with golden hair was searching for a friend. A toy soldier marched up and took her hand. They were a perfect blend. In the bedroom were a boy and a girl, asleep in Christmas dreams. The soldier saluted. The doll gave a kiss. At least that's the way it seems. Now everything began to tire and the toys went back in place. But when Mother woke in the morning, you should have seen her face. The tree was fine. The gifts were there. Yet Mother gave a roar. She looked at her wet shoes and yelled, "What's this puddle on my floor?" And that is a Christmas poem for you, and I hope you have a good Christmas. And to go on, Mike Pence Group poaches heritage leaders. Former Vice President Mike Pence's political group reportedly is hiring away top officials from the Heritage Foundation, deepening a simmering power struggle inside the conservative movement as Republicans battle over what comes after the Trump era. Pence's Washington-based organization, Advancing American Freedom, plans to bring on roughly 15 heritage employees, including seven prominent leaders, the Wall Street Journal has reported on Monday. The exodus of top heritage staff and fellows has gained momentum after the think tank's president, Kevin Roberts, refused to criticize Tucker Carlson's anti-Semitism or dissociate the organization from the podcaster. Pence told the Journal he has long respected heritage, but now the organization is abandoning its principles, citing what he described as an embrace of big government populism, tolerance of anti-Semitism, and a shift towards isolationism, evidenced by pulling back support for Ukraine in its war against Russia. Pence has also objected to heritage backing some tariffs and supporting Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as Health and Human Services Secretary. Among those joining Pence are John Malcolm, who led Heritage Legal and Judicial Studies Center, Kevin Diarranata, head of Heritage Data Analysis Center, and Richard Stern, director of the think tank's Economic Policy Studies Institute, according to the Journal. AAF later announced the addition of Malcolm, Stern, Diarranata, and 10 others in a Monday press release. I am proud to be joining Advancing American Freedom with some terrific colleagues as the head of the Edwin Meese III Institute for the Rule of Law. Exciting times ahead, Malcolm posted on X. The shakeup comes as conservative institution and donors jockey for influence heading into the next political cycle, with President Donald Trump's term ending in January of 2029. Heritage, for its part, is pushing back hard against the narrative that is losing control. In a statement to Newsmax, Heritage Chief Advancement Officer Andy Olivastro said the organization's mission is unchanged and insisted leadership is strong and decisive. He also accused departing staff of disruption and disloyalty, saying alignment with Heritage mission and loyalty to the institution are non-negotiable. Olivastro told Newsmax that Malcolm and Jessica Reinsch were terminated for conduct inconsistent with Heritage mission and standards, alleging breach of fiduciary duty and intellectual property removal. He said the group aims to strengthen the conservative movement nationwide. The staffing fight follows recent turmoil at Heritage, including Robert's defense of Carlson, after he conducted a softball interview with white nationalist and Holocaust denier Nick Fuentes. Carlson has also used his podcast to directly attack Jews, including by using anti-Semitic tropes that Jews control the banking system, Congress, the Pentagon, and even President Trump. Two Heritage board members, longtime philanthropists Abby Spencer Moffat and Shane McCullough, resigned Tuesday amid the backlash, citing concerns about the think tank's direction and what they viewed as insufficient condemnation of anti-Semitism. These board members joined respective conservative Robert P. George, who quit the board in November. Senior Heritage Fellows have also been quitting, including economist Stephen Moore and legal scholar Chris DeMuth. This week, Heritage Senior Editor Josh Blackman also resigned. He wrote a scathing letter to Roberts condemning his actions in the wake of the Carlson-Fuentes interview. "Your initial remarks were indefensible," Blackman wrote. Blackman continued, "Your apology was was underwhelming, and the lack of meaningful follow-up over the past 3 months has been telling. For reasons only you know, you aligned the Heritage Foundation with the rising tide of anti-Semitism on the right. These significant departures have added to pressure on Heritage leadership and fueled questions about whether the organization is drifting from the principles that once made it a dominant force in the conservative policy-making circles." And also from Newsmax, cautious shoppers step up holiday season spending. Consumers stepped up gift-giving during the first 7 weeks of the holiday shopping season, according to new data released Tuesday. But uncertainty about the economy is making shoppers more targeted in their buying. From November 1st through Sunday, cash and credit card sales rose 4.2%, which is less than 4.8% increase during the same period a year ago, according to Visa Consulting and Analytics Division. The data, which excludes sales from auto dealerships, gas stations and restaurants, are not adjusted for inflation or the impact from President Donald Trump's tariffs. When adjusted for inflation, retail rose a more modest 2.2% for the first 7 weeks of the holiday period, according to Visa's U.S. principal economist Michael Brown. That compares with the inflation adjustment 3% in the same year-ago time frame. "It's certainly not a spectacular season," Brown told the Associated Press. "It's sort of an average holiday season given concerns about macroeconomic growth, inflation. There's still a lot of uncertainty among the consumer population." MasterCard Spending Pulse, which also tracks cash and credit card spending, said that the sales rose 3.9% from November 1st through Sunday. That's above its 3.6 forecast for the overall season, but also lower than last year's 4.1 increase during the same period. Shoppers blended online and in-store shopping to find the best deals and maximize convenience, said Michelle Meyer, chief economist at MasterCard Economics Institute.